The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda and is intended for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. Please consult with professionals before making healthcare decisions.
Once you're in Rare, you come into that room and you're meeting with anybody, you are now the expert on this Rare team. Not the person you're meeting with, unless it's the person who discovered it or works on it.
That voice belongs to Bo Bigelow, co-founder of the Rare Disease Film Festival and the Disorder Channel. Bo joins the pod to talk about the Disorder Channel's collaboration with Global Genes and their Rare Disease Patient Summit coming up, and to discuss this fascinating article from the New York Times, The Wilderness of Rare Genetic Diseases and the Parents Navigating It. Bo also shares some of his family's personal journey in rare disease and how that led to starting the Stronger Every Day podcast. But before we get to all that, hello and welcome to the Bloodstream podcast. I am your host, Amy Board, alongside co-host, wait for it, co-host, Patrick James Lynch.
Hello, Amy Board. I'm proud to be your co-host, reporting remotely here from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah, you sound weird. Where are you? Cleveland, Ohio?
Yes, Cleveland. Yes, I'm in Cleveland, Ohio, where I spent Labor Day with some family here in a very safe and distanced way in the great outdoors of Ohio, in the middle of this fine land. And it's been rejuvenating. I also think my dog might want to move to Ohio.
Oh, I get it. I mean, if I was an LA dog and then I discovered Ohio, like the flatness and the greenness of Ohio, I'd be like, I want to be in Ohio. I get it.
He met deer yesterday.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really bark. It's not like one of his moves. Unless he really wants you to play with him, then his one bark seems to be, play with me, play with me, play with me. That's like what he's worked out bark-wise. But when he saw these deer, his whole body got stiff. Like, you know, processing thing I've never seen before starting to take place, which I found really fun. And I'm like, where is this going to go? And then he went nuts and just started barking, 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 which, one, annoying, and at 7 in the morning, please don't do that. Two, the deer, not really perturbed by that. In fact, one of them started walking closer to us and they were only about 20, 25 feet away. So I was like, I don't really know deer etiquette, but I do know that this place is way overpopulated and you're way too comfortable. So me and Yappy over here are gonna get a move on, which we did, but it was a lot of fun to witness. He's discovering all sorts of things here in Ohio.
Oh my gosh. It makes sense though. I mean, I think you've said this on the podcast before, but you are everyone knows you're a huge NBA fan, and now your dog is a legitimate NBA fan, and look at him flourishing in LeBron James' homeland. Like it feels
non-coincidental. Yeah. I couldn't agree more, Amy. Yeah. I think it's evidence of something very important to pay attention to.
I do too.
Yeah, we're gonna keep an eye on things. But his love of basketball is real. His love of Ohio is real. His being named after a basketball player is real. And yeah, all's going well. What about you? Where you have equipment and probably sound far more professional than I do this week. How's your living?
Yeah, that's because I'm the host this week. Because I'm the one with the professional equipment. My Labor Day was chill. All I did was watch Alaska shows with my boyfriend. We watch Alaska shows.
No, you're the host. I need to back away.
Actually, no. Like you have much better. I'm always a singular host. Like I do better, like singular, like monologue. And so the talking and the transitions, you're so much better than me.
Oh, we should definitely leave this part in because I just want everyone to hear the compliments.
Me too.
You know what I was going to just mention though? Today, the day this episode comes out is 9/11, mm-hmm. which is bizarre to think that was 19 years ago. And I'm sure next year there'll be a lot more discussion around it when it's not an election year and COVID and our kids going to go to school and 19 isn't 20, but like 19 years, which, you know, going to be 35 this year. Like I was in high school. I certainly remember being in high school in Western Long Island, and from the top of the grammar school across the street from me, you could see the smoke coming out of Lower Manhattan. And the creepiest part was when we were in class, I went to an all boys private high school on Long Island. And
wow.
I mentioned that, I mean, it's kind of interesting from a few perspectives when you think about a national tragedy occurring and like the environment that you're in. But we had a number of students whose parents either worked in the World Trade Center or the immediate surrounding. So I remember in my classroom of like 38 to 40 students, actually the president of the school was teaching my religious studies class when the two attacks happened. So his secretary came in, that would happen once in a while. And she pulled him out and he went outside and came in a few minutes later. Didn't think too much about it. Again, that happened once in a while. But when X minutes later, it happened again, and he was outside a little bit longer, we were all sort of like, this is different. Mm-hmm. And he came back in and, you know, of course, this is all pre-cell phone. We didn't have TV in the classroom, all that stuff. And he apologized for the secrecy and said, you'll all understand shortly. And then about a half hour later, the next class had started, actually, which is crazy to me. There was 1,500 of us, 1,800, I don't know, students and faculty, so many human beings. But because there was not televisions on, because no one had a phone, because internet wasn't just everywhere, like we transitioned from third to fourth period or whatever time it was. And then in the next class, there was an announcement over the loudspeaker about what had happened. They asked anyone who had a parent who was working in or around the Trade Center to please come down to the library. And there were like six or seven kids from my class who, you know, got up and went downstairs. I didn't see a thing until I got home from school that afternoon off the bus, by which time I had heard 30,000 people are dead. I had like the rumor mill went nuts because my school was one of, in my conversations over the last many years, I have found very few who just kept going with the day as planned, no turn the TVs on, go learn biology.
I have not heard that story to like, of especially in Long Island, to just keep going. Wow.
It says a lot actually about the philosophy of that school. But what about you? Do you remember what was your experience in Colorado?
I was in college actually. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and and it's interesting because it bookended. I was a senior in college, and my freshman year in college is when Columbine happened. And Columbine, of course, happened in Littleton, Colorado, where I am from. And I had a very close group of theater friends that went to Columbine. They were in the school. And so it mirrored that in terms of feeling completely helpless and not being able to contact my family. I remember the day that Columbine happened, watching it unfold and trying to call my mom, and I couldn't get a hold of my mother until like 9:00 p.m. I mean, like the phone lines were just, and 9/11 had that feeling as well. But I went to class that morning, and they immediately told us to go home. And I don't remember what they said, but they were like, something's happening, and to go home. So I went home, and my roommates were watching it, and we were just sitting there. I remember I still had my book bag on. So like my roommates were on the couch, and I was standing there, and we were just like watching the TV, and we watched the second plane hit. So we saw it in real time, and we were just by the TV the whole time. But it had the same Columbine effect that I felt, away from it and not able to engage with it. And obviously there was no social media, so I couldn't, and I couldn't get through to my mom, and there was just this helpless feeling. It was interesting.
Yeah. It was such a bizarre period. I am thankful I didn't witness either of, I mean, I guess you can only witness the first live if you were there, but I am appreciative that I don't necessarily have that memory, if that makes sense. But at the same time, if I was in a leadership position and there was some kind of national crisis of that purport, I mean, I guess these days too, you just could not hold that kind of information back in an environment with several hundred to a few thousand people because of technology. But it was one of the experiences where my real antiquated old school, all boys educational environment in the, you know, pre-technology boom era really felt, like some storybook other world where like everything's falling apart and I'm stuck with a tie on and all these boys and like we just don't know what's going on.
It's crazy.
And it's right over there. It's right there.
I have not. That's crazy. Have you been to the memorial?
I have, yeah.
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 They did a great job. That was very it was very moving.
Yeah. Bizarre time. So good. I'm glad we took a second to, that's so interesting to hear about. Yeah. I didn't even process like Columbine and like that in relation to both your age and 9/11. Like That's really interesting to think about.
Yeah, it was just I just remember that day feeling like standing there, just like bringing back those moments of calm. And Columbine was so personal just because it was my very own hometown and I was in Michigan. And, you know, 9/11 didn't feel as personal. I didn't feel like I had like connections there, but the helplessness of just like standing there was the same thing. I'm glad we touched on it just a little bit. Like, I feel like this day is like, it's important to remember those things and share those things. It's a sacred day. It's a day that we can, you know, remember what it was like coming together as a country.
You know, Amy, one last thought. I mentioned being in Ohio with my family, and you know, I've been here for a little over a week. So we've had a number of conversations about the world we're living in, society, culture, social movements, politics, and Ohio is an interesting state to have those kind of conversations with your mixed family. And when we talk about 9/11, and I was thinking about this over the weekend, and how this idea of never forget is attached to 9/11, never forget, like kind of immediately those two words bring up that day. And for the reasons you just stated, it's important. We should remember what that day meant, what happened, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the wars that we are still in as a result of that day. And it's for that exact same reason that when we say never forget, we don't also then have people rise up and say, yeah, well, what about the Oklahoma City bombing? Yeah, well, what about, you know, there was a shooting over there once. What about this thing? Okay, well, what about, you know, there's this other terrible event that occurred. Yes, there's more than one tragedy in the world, but this one has a unique place in history, and therefore it is appropriate for us to give it its own little moment. The Holocaust was a catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. It's okay if it gets a little bit of a heightened placement when we talk about bad events in history. And for the same reason, Black Lives Matter doesn't mean all lives don't. It means you have to put the attention where the crisis is. And when Black lives are not being murdered and incarcerated at rates that suggest nothing short of racism, then we can ease up a little bit on the need to call forward that Black lives matter. And having those conversations this weekend and making similar, less podcast family friendly analogies as well. For us, it created a dialogue on why something that for some is so triggering and brings them down a road that is really painful. How to maybe think about that a little bit differently, how to step out of whatever association they may have and just sort of use this timely example of, hey, this is a period of history that we do highlight a little bit differently. And it's not because these other things that have occurred are unimportant or can be forgotten about, but the attention's a limited commodity, and it needs to go where it needs to go. So it feels related to me, and I'm inclined in Ohio on 9/11 to want to bring that up.
Well said. Absolutely well said. And I think, you know, in the, I don't know, these conversations are so important. And I've been very struck by I've lived now 40 years, and it just seems like these conversations are starting to be had in ways that are difficult. I mean, I think we've lost the ability to argue well as a whole. Like, we're not good at it at the moment. You know, I think what's being mirrored to us by our leaders is not helping, and it's a thing. But to, you know, I think in the spirit, like last week's podcast, in the spirit of giving back, in the spirit of let's have our discourse, let's continue the dialogue. But there are people on the ground that have been doing this work for years and years, for decades and decades, and to acknowledge and amplify that work is so important as we, you know, might have dividing ideals or thoughts or what we should give, you know, our money to. But it just brings for me, I guess, today on of all days, you know, that it's wonderful to think that way and to continue giving back. And just well said, friend. Well said.
Well, I know we should move on to setting up your conversation with Bo. Can I give you two quick pieces of housekeeping before we do that?
Oh my gosh, please. Great housekeeping items, I might add.
Wheels for the World, we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. And it is still going on through September 15th, Save One Life's fundraiser in honor of Barry Hardy and all that he did for Save One Life and our global bleeding disorders community. Wheels for the World asks you to commit to riding either 25 or 62 outside live or virtual miles. And if you want to join an amazing team of people, look, there's not a big commitment. You donate a little money, you say, I'm going to ride. You're going to ride or you're not. It's like an honesty policy thing. Or you can join the Believe Limited team where Natalie and I are drumming up unnecessary competition so that you can have some fun with it as well. So check out Save One Life's website, go to the Wheels for the World fundraiser and help support their extraordinary work. And then finally, Stop the Bleeding is now fully out. It's out on all the platforms. So if you missed any of the 10 episodes or missed all of the 10 episodes, you can find them on the Stop the Bleeding Facebook, Instagram pages, as well as on YouTube or embedded on stbhemo.com. And a big old shout out to our supporter on that, Takeda, who's also the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast. How about that, huh? See, that's a little co-host slide in of the
amazing
sponsor shout out right
it
there.
It was amazing.
It right in.
It was so right in. Amazing. Bleedingdisorders.com. Thank you, Takeda. We appreciate it.
And now a quick word from our friends at Global Genes about their upcoming Patient Advocacy Summit.
Hi, everyone. Please join us for Global Genes Live, a rare patient advocacy unsummit. This two-week event celebrates and advances the causes of the estimated 400 million rare disease patients worldwide. Patients, caregivers, advocates, healthcare professionals, researchers, partners, and allies from the rare disease community will participate in a series of interactive and educational online experiences designed to connect, empower, and inspire everyone to accelerate change in rare disease and raise global awareness. Throughout September, a variety of interactive and educational online events, meetups, workshops, and performances will provide members of the rare disease community with opportunities to connect and engage with each other. Participants will gain insights about the latest in rare disease innovations, best practices for advocating on individual and organizational levels, and actionable strategies they can implement immediately to accelerate change. Please visit www.globalgenes.org to learn more about this event and to register. We hope to see you there.
Should we talk about Bo?
Let's please talk about Bo. I'm excited that I get to interview Bo, have some time with Bo, because I have not had time with Bo like you have. And so this will be great. Tell me about your relationship with him. How did you meet him? Like, where did you guys connect? Because you have some similarities, I think.
Yeah, so we connected over the Rare Disease Film Festival, which Bombardier Blood was a part of last fall, September, October, November. I think it was November, so about a year ago. So in the run-up to that, I connected with both him and Daniel, his co-founder there. The two of them are parents of children with rare diseases. As Bo, I'm sure he'll talk about this in a little bit, but he was a lawyer and then gave that up to be a full-time caretaker. And his daughter has, I believe it is called USB7. I just clicked off of USP as in Peter, USP7. And that led Bo to also creating a podcast that's called Stronger Together, the Stronger Together podcast, where he speaks about his experience with the family and all that they're going through. And Amy found this excellent article. Again, you're like our article curator of the of the last few weeks. That was about the rare disease experience, but specifically the challenges that parents are facing in navigating the era that we're living through. So Bo, as someone who I'm a big fan of, the Rare Disease Film Festival, and now the Disorder Channel, which is an online platform that's available through certain services. I know it works in conjunction with Roku. I obviously don't know how Roku works, but if you do, you can find the Disorder Channel. And Stop the Bleeding is a part of the Disorder Channel, so we've been talking recently about that as well. But Bo's also going to be part of the Global Genes Summit that's coming up here in just a matter of days. There is a Rare Together, Watch Together 3-night event where films that have been curated by the Disorder Channel will be shown as part of the summit and have a talk back component to them as well. So we'll have a link in the program notes if you want to learn more about that. But we asked Bo to come on to talk a bit about that, as well as to tell us more about his life in the world of rare disease as a rare disease parent.
And I think what struck me so much, slowly getting into the ultra rare disease community, the global genes community, is how instrumental these parents are in their advocacy work to not only bring awareness to their child's disorder, but to bring researchers into the fold to start working on potential treatments. And it's just a different fight. And so I think the films that are being shown and curated are in particular just to get the story out of these very rare diseases to hopefully match with, you know, a group of researchers, a grant project, something to, yes, you know, look at these diseases to, you know, enter into, you know, some type of clinical trial. And it's just a different fight. And I was really drawn to this article because it tells this story. It tells this story, yeah, that it really opened my eyes last year. I went to the Global Genes conference last year, and it really opened my eyes of, oh, this is a journey that I didn't realize was happening. And these parents truly, I believe, are the reason that so many of these novel therapies are accelerating, oh, yeah, to the you know, speed that they are. The money that's being put into it. There's a, you know, Orphan Disease Act that was, you know, enabled by Congress to, like, you know, help create incentives for these companies and these researchers to, like, you know, dig into these orphan diseases, mm-hmm, that affect, you know, less than 10,000 people across the globe or something like that. So, right. Bo is a unique voice, and I'm excited to have him on to share his story.
And, you know, what you were saying about the Global Genes experience you had, and sort of the eye-opening nature of the rare disease experience beyond hemophilia and bleeding disorders, right? That's like, oh, from a broader perspective, the rare disease parent experience is, there's uniquenesses there. That we in bleeding disorders don't necessarily appreciate. But Bo's conference, his and Daniel's Rare Disease Film Festival, what's also very intriguing to me about that and the work that they're doing is that connecting these power of one types, you know, these excellent parents with these excellent researchers and these really interesting storytellers and these scientists, like Bo and Daniel are very interested in that. So I probably saw like 30 some odd films when I was there too. There's a lot of short films. So it wasn't like, you know, days of just eyes, you know, stapled open. A lot of short films, but there was such concerted effort to try to help make the connections, and networking and connecting is always a part of events, but it was different. There was an intentionality and an urgency and a desperation that I'm not used to at either a film festival or frankly, a bleeding disorders patient meeting or conference of any, mm-hmm, kind. And that to me stood out as something really special. So I for one, am glad that through COVID, through having to make everything digital, shifting toward their focus on the disorder channel, at least for the time being, this work with Global Genes on putting together digital and virtual events, I'm just glad to see that they're continuing to plow ahead because they're on to something with how they are curating the stories, the content, and the people who, to your point, Amy, will be the individuals when partnered who make the big difference.
I agree. I'm excited to have him on. Should we get to
it? Have fun. Yeah, I'll have to listen on the other side. So this is where I go away and then we'll pretend that something happened and I'll come back at the end.
Woohoo! Selfishly, because I haven't heard your story. Will you tell me your story? Tell me your story of your daughter and that the diagnosis journey and how you got connected with Global Genes and all the things.
So she is 10. Her name is Tess, and she's our second child. Our first child, Dana, her brother, was like doing everything really early, like walking early, talking early, and just kind of way ahead of the curve in terms of milestones. And everything that I had read about kid two is that they sort of hang back a little because usually their older siblings like doing everything for them and talking for them. And so Tess was behind on all that stuff. And my wife thought something might be wrong, like something might be awry. And I didn't. I thought we should just give it time. Let's just wait. But what was happening is that she was really kind of checked out. She was just kind of like staring straight ahead and didn't seem to be responding to us. Didn't seem to know whether we were in the room or not, whether we were with her. And she was just checked out a lot of the time. What my wife and I used to say all the time was like, she's in there. We would kind of try to reassure each other by saying that, like, our girl is in there. We just got to figure out a way to get her out. And over time, the delays were such that it became undeniable. Like, there's definitely something going on. So we started this diagnostic journey of like trying to figure out what was happening with her and why she was having so many issues with like vision and GI stuff and her hips. She wasn't walking. She didn't walk till she was 5. She wasn't talking, and we didn't know what it was. And so we started to just go see all these different specialists, starting with neurology and orthopedists and language professionals, just anybody we thought could help us. We would start to go see all these people. And part of that was genetics. And the way she presented, it seemed a lot like it might be some of these, not, they're all rare, but they're like the more common rare diseases, like Angelman syndrome and Prader-Willi, like the ones that most of us have heard of. So these geneticists would say like, oh, I think this is Angelman. I'm pretty sure that's going to be it. Let's do the test for that. And I'm sure that's going to come back positive and we'll have an answer for you guys. And it was really an isolating time. I think that's one thing that doesn't get talked about enough, I think, in terms of rare disease, is that until you have your answer, until you get some kind of diagnosis and an answer, you don't belong to any sort of tribe. You're really different. You know, you go to the playground or whatever and your kid's not walking and talking and is steadily, you know, falling behind her peers in terms of what she can do. So she doesn't really belong with her age group, with the kids that she's the same age as, and you know, you're thinking that she might have this rare disease, but you don't know. And until you find that, you don't really belong anywhere. You're just kind of alone and you're just trying to figure out by yourself. It's just an isolating time. And so each time we would say, okay, Angelman, like maybe that will be our tribe. And we would go to their Facebook group and just kind of read posts and be like, oh wow, you know, like, yeah, Tess has that. That symptom is so Tess. Like, this might be it. This might be us. And over and over, they were all negative, negative, negative. And eventually it became just a thing that's so rare that our geneticist said, my list is done. Like, I've crossed it all off of the list that I think it could be. And, you know, the one that we were working with here in Portland, like, had a list, an actual like index card that she kept in her breast pocket, like wore it to work every day with her. And she's like, this is going to be one of the people that I just don't have an answer for. And like, I'm going to write her name on this list and I'm going to keep it with me. There's only another couple people on this list that I've never figured out. And Tess is one of them. So sorry, but that's it. And that was it. We didn't really have anything more we could do. And then we had a team here in Portland, in Maine, where we're from. And then there was a team in Boston that was also working on this puzzle. And they were sort of competing against each other, which was great. Like, I'm going to find out. Oh, I am. And we were like, yeah, somebody, please. And eventually they teamed up and they mapped her genome. They got it paid for. This was in 2013. It was like crazy expensive compared to now. And it is still expensive, but it was much higher then. So they got it done for us for free. They got it funded by a grant for research, essentially. And we got an answer. We got this gene that was mutated in Tess, but not my wife and me, called USP7. And even when we had that, it wasn't really an answer because there was no accompanying tribe. There was no Facebook group. Like, I got home from getting that result. I went straight to the computer, you know, Googled it. That's what you do when you're trying to figure out rare diseases. Like, Google is your friend, Google and Wikipedia. Yeah. And there wasn't anything out there about USP7. So we had another about a year and a half when we just didn't know that it was a disease. We didn't know of anyone else in the world who had this thing. And we just kept like hoping that maybe there'd be one other person someday that had it. And so in the summer of 2015, I was reading an article. It was in the New Yorker, and it was about two dads, both of whom had kids with a rare disease. And one of them was this computer science guy named Matt Mite. And he was in the same position we were, where he thought his kid was the only one in the world, and he knew the name of the gene, but he didn't know of anybody else. And he's like, well, let's put the computer to work here. Let's like use the internet to find more patients. So he had a whole method that was described in this article of like a blueprint, essentially, that you could use the internet to find more patients. And it's like, it's about writing a blog post and loading it with this just kind of genetic terminology, basically, and put it out there on the internet and let it spread if it's going to. And so I followed his blueprint exactly. And my wife and I, you know, put together this blog post together, and we put it out there and we took this deep breath and we were kind of saying, you know, maybe someday we'll find one other patient. Let's like cross our fingers and hope. And 24 hours later, we got an email from this guy. He said, my name is Mike Fountain and I work in a lab at Baylor College of Medicine. And I work on this gene. We're about to publish the first paper ever about this disease. I know of other patients and we should talk. So my wife and I got on the phone with Mike that afternoon, and he's like, yeah, there's 7 others. Test would be number 8. And this is a thing. This is a disease. Like, you guys were right. And this is a thing. And these are the symptoms. And he described them, and they were like, so many of them were things Tess had. And that was it. Tess was number 8. That was 5 years ago. Now we have the foundation and 71 patients up from the 8 that we had. So yeah, it's been a ride for sure.
Oh my gosh. I'm just so struck by the, I don't think people can even fathom not having any answers like from the medical community and like what that must be. And, you know, we look to the medical community as this beacon, and it's just that's just not the case in rare and ultra rare diseases. And what is that like? And to sit there for so long, you guys sat there for so long, and so many parents do.
Yeah, I think I love doctors. My wife is a doctor, so I'm certainly not going to bash the medical community, but it's just kind of a shift that my wife and I have both had to do, which is once you're in rare, you come into that room and you're meeting with anybody, you are now the expert on this rare disease. Not the person you're meeting with, unless it's the person who discovered it or works on it. But like all the professionals who treat tests, you know, a great example is vision. You know, we had this feeling, like I mentioned earlier, that she wasn't seeing us, that she was checked out. You'd snap in front of her eyes and there was no response. She wouldn't blink. She wouldn't flinch. There was just a disconnect there. And so we went to an eye doctor. We went to an ophthalmologist, and he's like checking out her eyes like anyone else. And he says, look, you know, these eyes are working. The rods and cones that make vision happen are firing. Like, everything in there is working, you know. And we felt like he was dismissing us, like saying, what you're seeing is something you're imagining, because I'm telling you the eyes are working. And, you know, we came to find out later that Tess has a thing that's called cortical visual impairment. And it's not about the eyes working. It's what the eyes are telling the brain. There's a disconnect between those two, the brain interpreting what the eye sees. And so, yes, the ophthalmologist is right. The eyes were working, but there was more going on there. And, you know, the next time we came into that office a few years later, you know, I met with one of the people that runs his office, and she's seated at a computer and is asking questions. This is about our son. And he's like, you know, any other vision issues in your family? And I'm like, yes, as a matter of fact. And I started to describe it, and she said, oh, CVI, cortical visual impairment. And it's a checkbox on her like computer. So I'm like, awesome. Like, you guys know about CVI now. That's great. It's like a thing. So, you know, it's really disheartening, I think, to realize like, oh, I'm not going to get an answer during this medical visit. Like, or if I do, it's only going to be about this system that's giving Tess a hard time, like her GI issue. I'm not going to get anything more than just some help with this issue, but I'm not going to solve what's causing all this. I'm not going to get a treatment today. I'm not going to get a cure. Like, I'm just going to be able to maybe better manage this symptom. And I think that's really hard.
One thing that I've been struck by in this community, slowly getting into like the global genes community and the rare disease community, is this ongoing fight, not only for awareness and fundraising, but also the match of the researcher, like trying to find a researcher that will, you know, take on your disease and take on the mystery. As a parent, can you like tell our listeners a little bit about that search. I mean, like really trying to find a researcher that will take you on as a family.
Absolutely. I early on in this process, like when we were just getting our diagnosis and trying to figure out how this all works, I realized that there's a lot of people out there who've already done a lot of this stuff. And the beautiful thing about this community is that everybody is willing to talk to you and help you and like share their homework. And so I was talking to a guy who's since become a good friend, Stuart Seidman. And you know, I had just gotten my diagnosis for TESS not too long before that. And I was just trying to find out from him. He had done a lot for his son, Ben, and, you know, kind of had been through the whole process of everything. And I was trying to find out from him how you can make people care. You know, what do you do? Because everybody's really busy and like they're going to blow off your email. They're not going to take your call. Like, especially researchers, they just have a ton going on. They're just busy. And how do you make people care? I asked him and he said, well, you're going to make them care. And you're going to show them about tests. You're going to bring them to tests or bring tests to them whenever you can, like in person. That's the best way. Once they meet her, they really can't say no. They gotta help you. You know, the reason that everybody gets into science for this stuff is to help real patients. And here you are with a real live person, your daughter, and you're making the effort to like get on a plane and go see them, or, you know, get in your car and go drive to their lab or whatever. Like, they're not going to be able to say no to you because you're going to make them care. That's mm-hmm. what you do now. That's your job. That's what you do. So I'm still learning about this. I think it's really hard because even when you find somebody who's a great fit for you and they're passionate about your project and your gene and your child and everything, circumstances change, pandemics happen, labs close, people quit. It's, you know, you can't count on everyone to stay in the fight with you all the time, even when they seem like they're going to. And so you're always looking for more people. You're always trying to build your group, and you're also talking to other people and you're saying, you know, I talk to other parents all the time. You know, who are you working with and what's their theory and what are they working on? And because I don't think there's enough collaborating among rare disease groups. I think there's so many times when, you know, you've got your foundation and you guys mm-hmm. fund something, you guys mm-hmm. have a crack scientist who's like really on top of things and she figures something out, and what she did in her lab, her exact work, could help tests. But mm-hmm. I don't know that because everybody's so private and mm-hmm. so worried about getting scooped, and they got to publish, you know, and I get that. I get that that's part of the landscape for scientists, but like, the more we can be a little bit more open and just say like, well, here's what we did. Here's the theory. You know, there's so many things that we're doing that can help each other. Mm. And so I think that's actually been a great sort of byproduct of this pandemic, is like people are just talking to each other more because we're all home and like, what else are we going to do? Right. But like, there's a lot more sharing, I think, and there's a lot more potential for that sort of collaboration. So
that's cool. What is Global Genes, that organization? And they have a annual summit. What has that meant to you guys and your family? And
oh man, Global Genes made a really big difference for me and for our family, because that summer that I was talking about, 2015, that's when we found our tribe, right? We know Tess is patient 8, and it's like, now what do we do? Like, there's this daunting process in front of us of like, you got to raise money, and how much do we need, and what do we do with it? And you know, for years we'd had all of our friends and family say, is there anything we can do? You know, Tess is 5, she's just starting to walk, she's not talking, and they're really watching to see like what's going on with her, and they care and they want to help. And for years we've said, I don't know what to tell you, there's nowhere you can go to donate anything. I mean, you know, there just was nowhere to direct everybody's sort of love and energy and generosity. And so that summer we got that answer, and that fall Global Genes was doing its summit, and my wife found out about it. She's reading something like online, and she's like, this, you are going to this. I'm buying you a plane ticket right now. And she buys me this ticket. I'm like, what? Global Genes? What is that? I don't know. She's like, you're going. Just, it's in California, SoCal. You're going. Pack your bags. And I'm like in California before I even really know what's happening. And it was awesome. Like, it was just what I was describing. Like, so many really supportive people who are like, oh, I'm 3 years down the timeline from where you are. Where you are now, I was there in 2012. And here's what I did. And here's, what's your email? I'm going to share all my docs with you right now. And they would like, you know, email me right there on the spot. I also met Daniel DeFabio that fall. He was another sort of creative guy. I was doing some writing about tests and just trying to sort of get my head around, what does this mean to me and how am I going to process this? And so I was just doing some writing to sort of, that was my way of dealing with it, just kind of like, you know, putting together some essays and things about tests. And so he had been doing some of the same stuff about his son, Lucas, who had Menkes disease. He had made a film about Lucas. So we connected on that front, like, oh, you're a creative guy. You've done some writing for The Mighty. So have I. I was in The Mighty. So like, hey, we should keep in touch. And so that was the beginning of this partnership that that continues to this day, that is all about film and rare disease. And we started a film festival together. So, you know, we kind of credit Global Genes with introducing us 5 years ago.
That's great. How, like, the very unique space of that creative need that the film festival, short documentary films, the podcast, how do they serve this rare disease community? Because I think it's so important, but I love that creative angle.
Yeah, I think the way we look at it, you know, I think about it this way with the podcast, but also the festival and the channel is, number one, it makes people more aware of all these diseases. You know, you're luckily, ideally, you're going to learn something. You're going to find out about a disease you haven't heard of before. And it also, I try to do this, especially with the podcast, is just make it clear that these are people, that Tess is a person, and this is what she likes. These are the things she doesn't like. Here's what her day looks like. Here's what her morning is. I think a lot of the films that we feature in the festival and on our channel do that same thing. It takes away some of the sort of mystery, I guess, about somebody who has a rare disease, and it allows you to come away and say, oh, like, Tess can't talk and she took a while to walk, but like, she likes Storybots, just like, you know, my kid. Or, you know, you come away with an idea of, like, you know, what somebody is about, and it's a more complete picture. And I think, you know, it's also a way to, like, one thing that Daniel and I say all the time is awareness is good, but it's kind of, we want more than that. We want people to be aware, and then we want them to do something. We want you to act, because both of us have seen, both with USP7, with our group, Tess's disease is called Howe Fountain Syndrome. It just got a name. So with Howe Fountain Syndrome and Menkes disease, you know, we see a lot of people being aware, and they find out about it, and then they don't do anything about it. They don't tell anybody else. They don't make any kind of donation. They don't share it with anyone. They don't come to an event. They just know about it, and then they just go on with their lives. And that doesn't really help us. I mean, it's better than nothing. We want them to be aware of the diseases, but we want people to do stuff, because that's when things happen. Daniel and I, with the festival, what we always wanted to do is spur these collaborations among all the rare disease stakeholders, because that's how cures happen. Like I was saying before, we feel like there needs to be more collaboration. And when you used to be able to go to a live event, you're at our festival and the films are over and you're getting a coffee in the lobby, and next to you is somebody that you've never met, and you get to talking, and, you know, next thing you know, you're trading cards. And 6 months later, you're like working on something together that can help them with their disease and you with yours, because they have a scientist that could help you, or, you know, they just funded a project that really, you know, the same thing would work for you, or, you know, they have a digital platform that's just what you've been looking for. I mean, we got to all be talking together more. And so that's really what all of this is about for us. Yeah.
So great. It's such a creative, important entry point for people to tell those stories. Where can people find the podcast? Where can they find the channel? Where can we direct folks?
The podcast is called Stronger Every Day. It's been around for just about 5 years now. It's wherever you get podcasts. I do one every week. It comes out every Wednesday. The point of the podcast is to kind of, it's sort of like my audio diary. I like to make it clear as often as possible that I don't have all the answers, that I'm really still learning a lot here. For a long time, for the first few years of the show, in case you go back and listen to old ones, I was swearing a lot. Give a little warning up front, just to kind of say, like, this is hard. Like, this is frustrating. Yeah. We love our Tess, and it's really hard to be unable to get her to talk, or it's really hard to go to a function and have someone come up and say something really deeply insulting and not even know that it's insulting. Or, you know, so I think I was swearing for a while. I cleaned it up so that we could have it be G-rated and people could listen as a family, because I heard that that was a thing. I wanted to make that possible. So it's been clean for a while. But, you know, you hear on the podcast, you hear it all, like, especially my failures, like the embarrassing, terrible day that I had where I just totally blew it. Like, I really want to be honest about that and just make it clear that I'm not an expert. There's some stuff I have managed to figure out. It's taken me a long time, but, like, mostly I have more questions than answers. And I'm always looking for people to give me answers if they have them, because I always have a lot to learn. So that's the podcast, Stronger Every Day. Our channel is called The Disorder Channel, and it's on Roku and Amazon Fire TV. And our film festival is called Disorder, the Rare Disease Film Festival. We are on a hiatus right now. We were going to be in New York this past May, but that didn't happen. And I'm not sure when we'll be able to return, because, you know, on the list of in-person events, I think we're actually below going to bars, because literally half of our audience is people with rare diseases, and they're the most, like, immunocompromised people. Totally. So I predict you'll be back in a bar before we have our before we have our festival, yeah. Unfortunately. But yeah.
But we can see some of the films right at the Global Gene Summit online if people register. Is that true? Is that a thing?
That's right. Yeah. So part of this year's Unsummit is we have some slates of films that we work together with Global Genes to present. And we have some themes that we feel are the right themes for right now. One of them is everybody's at home and thinking about illness more than they ever have before, and thinking about, like, cures more than they ever have before. And so we have a whole slate of films that's about rare disease. And these are the films where people got it. They, like, worked on a cure, and they found a treatment that is seems to be working right now, seems like it could be a cure, some success stories. So we have a whole slate about that. We have another one that is called Just Diagnosed Rare. And that's really about the feeling I told you before, that summer before I went to Global Genes, where you're kind of like, you get your answer and you're saying, now what do we do? And that feeling of sort of that your universe just changing in such a dramatic way. So we have some films about that. And then we have another one that's devoted entirely to the siblings experience, because we think that's an important piece of it. Daniel has, his son Lucas passed away actually this summer. But Lucas had a brother, Alex. So Daniel has been dealing with this for years, you know, a sibling who's typical and a child who has a rare disease. And we have the same thing in our house. We have Tess, and then her brother Dana is 14, and he's neurotypical. And so what's that like? You know, how can you be a parent? How can you make sure you give enough attention to your typical kid? How do you bring them through, you know, childhood without screwing them up too much? You know, they know too much. They grow up way faster than you want them to. You want them to just be these carefree kids, and just they just can't. You know, it's just not going to work with what you have going on in your household. So how do you do that? How do you navigate that? How do you be the best parent you can? Those kinds of questions we think are really, really crucial to think about. So those are the themes, and we're really excited to work with Global Genes. You know, like I said, we got started there. We met there 5 years ago, and it's really fitting, we think, that it kind of come full circle, and that they were really generous in giving us the spot, 3 nights, some great hosts, some podcasters who are going to be hosting, and we're thrilled about it. We can't wait to do it.
How is Tess doing today? To kind of close out, how's she doing today?
She's doing great. She loves going to school, and after months of driving to an empty campus and not having anyone there, now we are having her actually go, and there's other kids there, and she's really thrilled to be there. She's rolling with the punches with masking and all that stuff, and so she's really, really happy to be back at school, and she's thriving, I would say.
That's so great. Thank you so much for coming on. It means the world. And just to share and amplify your story is cool. It's really cool.
Thanks for having me, Amy. It was great.
Absolutely. I want to thank Bo for joining us today. You guys make sure to check out the Stronger Everyday podcast and the Disorder Channel, which is on Roku and Amazon Fire, one of the ways that you can help support the rare disease community. And Bo in particular is to install that channel. There's going to be original content and resources for parents for rare disease. And also, Stop the Bleeding, our very own Stop the Bleeding, is already on the channel. I think they have seasons like 1 through 6 already on the channel. So make sure to install the Disorder Channel on Roku and Amazon Fire to get involved. And if you're interested in attending the Unsummit with Global Genes, that is going to be September 14th through the 25th. And you can see the virtual film festival, which will be September 16th through the 18th, head on over to their website. Let me see. It is globalgenes.org. So go to globalgenes.org to check out the films and also that summit. They have really great information, and it might be a cool community for all of us to get involved in. And that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited who makes this podcast possible. And thanks as well to our presenting sponsor, Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, to learn more. Subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast wherever you listen. Leave us a rating in the Apple Store. Share this episode with a friend. Word of mouth is the best way that we reach new people. Hey, do you have a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? Want to share your bleeding disorder story on the pod? Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. You'll find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or you can follow Patrick and myself on Twitter and Instagram. We're easy to find. Reminder to check out the show notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links and information related to the segments and stories featured on this episode. I am your host, Amy Board, and this week, my co-host,
Patrick James Lynch.
Hey, we'll be back next week with another episode of the Bloodstream Pod. And until next time, remember, the strength you're searching for resides in you.
Bye, everybody.